basically SUVs. Everything wrong with the world, frankly.
You're about to ruin my joke. Leave it alone.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show. It's our chance to just talk mindlessly about all things classic cars. And as ever, I'm joined by Jeff Ruggles and Joe Miller.
Hello, everyone.
So, guys, let's crack on. Now, we're recording this not long after last week's episode. So the ability to talk about all matters topical might be a bit of a challenge.
Yes. You're going to save me, aren't you?
I am. It's not particularly topical, but I wanted to share, it's topical in my house, is I've just acquired the fantastic book called The Viking and the Samurai, which sounds like some sort of adventure novel, but it is in fact the excellent account by John Backus of the British Leyland Honda collaboration. Obviously, there's loads of accounts of what happened with British Leyland, and we talked about British Leyland a few episodes ago. All this talk about rubbish factories, poor industrial relations, wishy-washy management, all those sort of things, a perfect storm of what could go wrong, did go wrong. But something new's come up when I read this book, which I hadn't really appreciated, was also the monumental levels of delusion within the company. That when they were talking with Honda, I think there were many people in the business who were very much aware of British Leyland's reputation for poor quality and bad reliability, particularly those responsible for international sales, trying to sell these products in Europe and North America and further afield. They were aware of the warranty claims and the sort of bad benchmarking against better opposition. But it strikes me in the book that he talks about how, particularly in the Austin Morris segment of the business, how they honestly thought that the cars were good enough and could stand up to international scrutiny. I think there was just this belief that they could just carry on with what they had, that there was no need to get better or improve. And I think that's really sad that level of bewilderment and delusion existed within the company. And that explains why it was held back in certain quarters and why, you know, good enough was
not
deemed to be good enough. Do you know what I mean? It's just terrible.
Could have done with Ford's marketing team, couldn't they?
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Just everything. I mean, a throwaway comment that he mentions in the last chapter I've just read is he actually raises a striking similarity between Honda and BMW, of course, played successive roles in Rover. But he says they're fundamentally engineering companies. They build good engines and are very adept at engineering and just happen to wrap cars around that engineering. I hadn't even thought about that Honda and BMW are actually quite kindred spirits, albeit from different parts of the world. But yeah, obviously, I can't wait to get stuck in. I'm only very much in the early throes of the collaboration, but my goodness, what it tells you about the state of the kind of British car industry at that time versus what our peers overseas were doing, certainly in places like Japan. We talked in last week's episode, of course, about MG's decision to build a factory in Spain. And in many ways, Japan in the 80s was that, wasn't it? It was trailblazing with its own factories back home and then looking to, you know, build a footprint in Europe, and the collaboration with British Leyland with Honda's initial attempt at doing that. And also we know that Nissan started with their Sunderland factory in 86 and so on. So it's a really good book. I can thoroughly recommend it.
It's very good. You have to get it from the Rover 200, 400 club, which is no hardship because they're a lovely bunch of people. They just let the NEC at various times and what have you, and they go to shows, but I believe you can buy it online. Yeah, I've read that book already. I can recommend it. It's excellent.
That's probably as much news as we dare discuss, given that we can't see into the future. But
it's lovely weather we're having.
Exactly. Yes. Is it? Yeah. Hopefully. Fingers crossed. But yes, let's go on to our buying topic for the week. And I think this was your suggestion, Joe. Obviously, you're a big fan of an estate car.
I love an estate car. Who doesn't love an estate car? If you don't, you're wrong.
Well, it dovetails quite nicely with your visceral hatred of SUVs.
It does.
Because I think your mindset is that why have an SUV when an estate car will do?
Yeah.
Yes. And believe me, when I say a friend of mine who is looking at having children is dead set on either a Qashqai or a RAV4. I cannot tell you the level of convincing I have tried to get her into a Golf Estate or an Octavia Estate instead. But that's another story. I won't go into it here, but basically SUVs are everything wrong with the world, frankly. They do everything worse. And
I won't go into it before going into it.
No. I'll keep it brief. We could fill this entire podcast with everything wrong with them, but they're everything worse and nothing better, and you pay more for them. Is the short version.
Regressively, Joe, I urge you to go and have a look at the top 10 best-selling cars in the UK.
Oh, I know.
And how many of them are SUVs will be quite sobering.
To be fair, I sat and thought about this. It's like, I'm not sure there actually are even 10 estate cars you can buy anymore. When you actually sit and think how many people still make estate cars,
yeah,
it's shockingly few.
It's quite unusual. I saw a guy drive past earlier in a Ford Focus ST estate, and I thought, he's made a good choice, isn't he?
He has. But why don't we make some choices of our own, gentlemen? Because we decided to weigh up our favourite classic and modern classic estate cars of all eras. It doesn't even have to be the most practical in the world, but we all love an estate car. Put the family, put the kids, hypothetical in my case, put the dog, etc., in the back and go and have a great time. And you can take it to a classic car show. Why not? Classic estate car has to be the ultimate everyday car, surely.
In your view, but yes,
objectively, it's fact.
But anyway, Jeff, you get us out of this SUV estate melee, please, with your first choice.
I'm going to start on familiar territory, and I'm very sorry to every listener especially after last week's podcast, which talked about minis a lot. But I'm going to start with a Mini. But so everyone switch off now. No, seriously, I'm going to plump for the Mini Clubman Estate because I never wanted one, and I'll tell you why I never wanted one because. It had the Clubman front end and the squared off rear end. So for me, a Mini needed to have at least one end that was the same as the original Mini. So, you know, the round nose front or the normal saloon rear. And the Clubman Estate had neither of those. My dad's got one. It's fantastic and I love it. And he's restored it, made a beautiful job of it. And of course, they're so practical. And that was proven at the IMM in Poland a couple of weeks back because there were loads of them there, a surprising amount. Because they're so useful for putting all your stuff in and traveling in a Mini with all your camping gear, no need for a roof box or anything like that. They're pretty cavernous for what they are. They've had a real role reversal, I think. Now, I looked at the auction figures for Mini Clubmans, excluding the 1275 GT, and the top three or four sales in recent years have all been estates. So that says it all to me. They're really practical. They're still a Mini.
Yeah, they still drive like a Mini. They're great.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the later ones have the 1100 engine, a bit more usable. I personally prefer, there was a crossover point, but I like them with the sort of mock D-Noc wood trim on the side and the vinyl seats. And they made them for, you know, 12 years.
Yeah.
Up until 1982. So there's still a fair few around. And I just think it's a really practical addition of a Mini.
It is lovely, and I applaud you on your choice. I think there's something just glorious about it.
Very cool.
I would absolutely have one. I totally agree. I actually love the idea of chuck a tent in the back and go to car shows in it. I think it would be fabulous.
Yeah, I just think they're great. They combine the sort of commercial space of the van, but with a bit more refinement.
Very cool choice, that.
Yes. Well, go on then. So top that, Mr. Miller.
Well, I'll save the obvious choice till last, but I last year, one of my absolute favourite cars I drove, so much so that I came home and started looking at them for sale and then probably realised I had nowhere to put it, is a car that I think looks even better as an estate car. It's arguably one of the best saloon to estate transitions ever. And that is the BMW E39 5 Series.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Fabulous car by all accounts. Go and watch our road test if you haven't. I loved it. It was an absolutely wonderful car. And as I say, they only get better because you've suddenly got this cavernous boot. Again, I love the way the styling translates to an estate. It's that right era of car where the saloon to estate, it looks natural. It's like it's meant to be there. And it's got little details like the glass hatch that pops open just to chuck a few things. You don't have to have the tailgate all the way open. And it's massive. And if you're a fan of Top Gear, you'll know that you can cross Africa in one as well. So yeah, I absolutely love the E39. I would have an estate. If it was me personally buying, I'd have a diesel and probably... No, I'd go manual, just for the interesting factor. But yeah, E39 Touring in any guise, you can make a good case for that being ultimate car. They look great. They drive well. They're built incredibly well. They are a proper BMW through and through. And actually, for what you get and the price you can get one for, I think they're a bargain at the moment.
You could probably fit the Mini Clubman in the boot.
I was just going to say, yeah, you could have the Mini as a little support car for it. Yeah, I think they're fabulous.
I think you're right. That BMW went through an increasing era where the estate model was better looking than the saloon. The estate models were always better looking and continue to be so today. So
I'd agree with that. E46 as well. Obviously, the only thing, they never did an E39 M5 touring, but a few people have built them, I believe. So yeah, that would be dream spec, would be E39 M5 touring. So if anyone would like to donate one of those to the channel, I'll repay you in sweets.
An awful lot of sweets.
A lot of sweets. Go on then, Mr. Well, Wing. Which Jaguar estate have you gone for?
Well, I'm impressed you went with the German estate car, and I suspect you may have chosen my first choice had I not already put it down on the list in the group chat. But I went with the Mercedes 124 estate.
The antique seller.
I just think they're wonderful, and I would quite happily just go all out with the spec, like a proper 300, whatever T, with the 7 seats, 4MATIC. I would go absolutely top end. I don't even know how much one of those is worth now. What, 10, 12, 15?
Maybe 15 or 20, depending on the spec, but you'd go proper middle class skiing holiday spec.
Yeah. I just think that would be superb. But truth be told, a ratty couple of grand one that might need a bit of welding would still suffice.
They're brilliant.
I just think they're...
I think they're a great example of a great value classic as well, because if you don't want the top spec, all the bells and whistles, the fact you can get into one for $2,000-$4,000, potentially, what, again, the definition of family classic, surely.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're great. But back to you then, Jeff. Give us something that isn't a Mini.
Yeah, I'm gonna switch it up for the second choice to one of what I think is one of the prettiest estates. That is the Alfa 156 Sportwagen. But specifically, 156 GTA.
Yes, good man.
Sportwagon. So you've got that wonderful Busso V6 with the polished inlet manifold. You've got seats inside that look like they should be in a Lamborghini Miura. You've just got so many neat little styling cues. I just think they're great. I remember trying to fit a stereo to one and the dashboard completely falling apart, but you put those things aside because it is so pretty.
Yes.
I just think they look brilliant. And to have a GTA would have the pace as well. Just think they look brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
And there weren't so many made, but, you know, you could probably pick up a usable one for low five figures, maybe around 10 grand, and a really, really nice one for a bit more than that.
I think that's a corking choice. And not many people would think of that either.
No, well, you know, quite obscure. So I've tastes, I guess.
I love it.
Tasteful and classy, much like yourself, sir.
It's a very, very pretty car. And I know you sort of scoffed at the interior, which is sort of made out of plasticine or something, but
it looks so good. The interior looks brilliant.
Yeah. And then in estate, guys, again, I think it's probably better looking than the saloon.
I think so. And but slightly more valuable as well. I've just checked. 1,678 were built.
Wow.
Very low.
A rarity as well.
Yeah. So, you know, I could be exclusive and stylish, which is obviously what everyone says about me.
We haven't announced all of our choices yet, but I'm going to hedge that's probably one of the best choices of of this group roundup. So
I agree with that.
Yeah. So go on in, Joe. We've got to try and beat that, which I think might be hard. But
my classic estate car of choice should be practical. It should be tough. It should be versatile. It should be classless. It should be easygoing. So my next two choices are both in that category, and this is the second best car for that brief, the Volvo 240. You cannot think classic estate car and not think Volvo 240. They take on the world and win. There's multiple cars out there with multiple millions of miles on. They're comfortable. They're relaxing. They're still a great, safe car. You can put 7 people in it. The boot is cavernous. You can move house with the things. Just wonderful, wonderful cars. You're not going anywhere very quickly, and you're going to use quite a lot of fuel. We're quite thirsty, but charming cars. And again, I think the Volvo 240 is a bit like the Morris Minor. It's one of those cars you can't hate. A Volvo 240, everyone likes them.
Yeah, so for those antique dealers that don't have the Mercedes W124 estate, they'll have the Volvo instead,
yes,
won't they? Because you can still fit the grandfather clock in the back and the numerous works of art.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're such a charming thing, because you could be anyone in that car. You could be an antiques dealer, you could be a builder who wants a cheap van, you could be the family man, whatever, you know, anyone could have. Everyone accepts a Volvo 240.
There's a painter and decorator in the village near here that still uses one as his workhorse, which I did think is brilliant. You know,
need to change it?
Why would you?
Exactly.
It's half life, isn't it?
Why do you need to change it? I mean, a nice Torslander or a GLT, I'd love one of those.
And they're still, I mean, they're not 500 quid like they used to be, because a lot of them got banger race and so on and so forth. But 5 grand or so would get you into one of those these days. And again, for how physically, how much car you get for that amount of money, I think it's a bit of a bargain.
Well, actually, that's a really good choice, because I think if memory serves, we compared your choice with my next choice, which is a Mark III Granada.
We did, way back when.
Yeah. I'm going with Mark III because I just think, shares them with the saloon and the hatch, I just think they've got the best seats in the business. Mm. Those lovely, plump, ideally leather, but I'd quite happily have the crushed velour as well. Yeah, and by the time you get to the Mark III estate with the facelifted interior, you've got this cavernous estate car with a nice interior. I think they look good with the facelifted front end.
They are lovely things. They're so refined. They're so comfortable. They're like a big lazy boy with wheels.
Yep. And I know you can get the Scorpio in the estate, the one that came afterwards, but I still would struggle with the Scorpio front end. So I prefer the Granada Mark III front end.
There's always that little amusing tidbit that the rear doors on the estate version are shared with the saloon or the hatch. So if you look very carefully at where the rear doors shut, they've had to sort of fondle a triangular bit of roof to make the door shut within it. It's the most, once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. It's the weirdest looking thing.
Well, I remember talking to Ian Callum, the Jaguar designer, about the X-Type estate. And he makes, because obviously he designed the Rover 75 estate as well when he was at TWR. But he remembered telling me about the fact that with an estate car, the requirement is you've got to have a slightly higher roof line because you want the luggage capacity and the practicality. But actually to do that and to cheat the lines of it is actually quite hard because the proportions then change. So yeah, I think that is always the risk with an estate car, is that the styling looks a bit odd. But I think certainly with Jeff's 156 choice, there's no danger of it.
No, it looks there.
Dud, that's for sure.
You've got that to live up to now then, Jeff. What's your third one?
Yeah, go on.
So normally I go for quite sort of achievable cars, don't I? But my third choice is probably not very achievable at all. It would be if it was a basic Audi 80 Avant, but this isn't. This is the RS2 variant.
You're on fire today, Jeff. You're on fire with these choices.
Built by Porsche, so, you know, pretty handy. Wearing Porsche Cup wheels. 5-cylinder, 4-wheel drive, massive turbo, 311 brake horsepower, 0-60 in 4.8 seconds. Looks great. Super exclusive. You'd probably need 45 grand to even get started. I'd want one in the iconic blue that they came in.
Yes.
What a machine.
Yeah, I think what an absolutely mega choice. I remember loving them when they first came out, and you see them every now and again, either come up at auction or a posh car show. And like you say, even at 45-50, you could argue, given its provenance, that that's still good value.
Pretty sure that was the sort of genesis of Audi's RS died as well. So
yeah, fastest date, certainly.
Yeah, very good. Joe, I daren't ask, but you've got to try and beat that. So,
well, you know what's coming. Obviously, my second choice was the Volvo, and I said solid, sturdy, practical, safe, versatile, classless, easygoing, and that was the second best car to do that. Of course, the best car to do that is the Mercedes S123, the estate version of my beloved W123. And this doesn't really need much explanation. I've talked about 123s forever on this channel. They're wonderful. They've got the self-leveling rear suspension in the estate, so you can load it up with all the filing cabinets and expensive paintings you like. You can get the 7-seat jump seats in the back and the built-in dog guard that slides up if you need to put dogs in the back. And they, again, another example of the estate, arguably kind of looking better than the saloon in terms of how well integrated it is.
Very elegant looking. Yeah.
They come with the built-in roof rails and everything. Yeah, elegant. Exactly. That's the word. And they look... There's a couple of the publicity photos that show it towing trailers and what have you, but also in front of a big stately home. And again, I think that proves it. That's another one of those cars that is utterly, utterly classless. Again, if I was having one, you'd have to have a diesel, I think, just for that real workhorse nature. But I'm not fussy. I think whatever spec they come in, they're wonderful cars. I absolutely love them. And the only reason I don't own one is because I've got the saloon version. So yeah, they're not cheap anymore. It's worth mentioning. The estates are well over 10 grand for a good one. And the best on the market are knocking on for £50,000.
Wow.
Whether they're selling for that, I don't know, but that's what they're priced at.
Beautiful. I think I applaud your choice. It's pretty much the absolute antithesis of Jeff's Audi RS2 choice.
RS2, but, yeah.
But could be had for about the same money. Should I say?
Yes.
That? Yeah. That's a fair comment. I'm not going to claim they're the fastest car in the world, but for, again, practical family classic that still makes you feel special, I don't think they come much better. And I say the only reason I don't have one is that I've got the saloon version.
Yeah, it's not. It's quite hard to jam a Jaguar choice in a segment about estate cars, but I've gone for it anyway. They've not had a huge track record of estate cars. They did have that XJ40 estate concept, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
And they're those XJS Aventa things, aren't they?
Yes, the Lynx Aventa.
Which look quite pretty, actually, but that's not what I'm choosing. And of course, the X-Type estate was the commercial success. It certainly did the X-Type numbers a world of good, particularly in Europe. I'm actually going for a very modern choice, which is the Jaguar XFRS estate car. It's a bit in the mold of your RS2 choice, Jeff, if you think about it. It's this mean beast with a 5-litre supercharged V8. A lot of our choices look better as estates than saloons, and I'm going to say the same of the XFRS as well.
Yeah, definitely.
It therefore also dispenses with that slightly over-the-top boot spoiler that the saloon has. So again, if you can find one, they're really rare. I just think, what a weapon.
Epical.
I would absolutely have one of those and keep it all day long, were it not for the fact that you could probably buy two XKRs for the same money. But
incredibly leery, aren't they? Because they're about 550 horsepower and rear-wheel drive.
What a machine. That's probably an estate car to buy and keep forever, I would say.
Drop the kids off at school and then do a rolling burnout away from the gates.
Yeah, exactly that. So, well, there's some fabulous choices there, gentlemen. I have to say we could probably keep listing estate cars of our choice. And one day, Joe, we'll let you go full pelt at your SUV hatred, which I think you've managed to jam into at least half a dozen videos in the past, if not more. So,
and every written article you've ever done.
Indeed. I make no apologies for it. I will not stop until every SUV is eradicated. So there you go.
Week's episode, you waxed lyrical about the Porsche Cayenne. So,
yeah, but as I said at the time, I'm okay with the Cayenne because it's actually capable.
So that's the definition, as long as it's capable.
And not a Land Rover, because they just break. But anyway, we'll move very swiftly on from that one.
Right, so what are we up to in the days ahead, gents? What's floating everyone's boat car-wise?
I think I'm going to try and head to Bewley on Sunday for the National Mini Day.
Yes, of course.
Not to mention minis again, but I think I'm going to try. I'm quite keen to get the 850 down there. Should only take me a couple of days.
Brilliant. That's really good. I'll mention this actually, because last week I was at the UK Garage and Body Shop show. It's a very tradey show, all about sort of UK aftermarket.
Can I clarify, by UK Garage, you mean garages that fix things, not music?
Workshops in the UK as opposed to a particular music genre.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Just to clarify, at the show was a 1935 Sunbeam Tourer that was owned by the same family for like 70 years. And it was on display as part of a local independent garage. And the garage had been in existence since 1958. And the significance of that, and it's still going to this day, so it's been going for 68 years. And the significance of that, which then prompted me, is that also in 1958, a certain magazine that we published called Car Mechanics started. I was speaking to the proprietor about, I said, look, we should definitely come up, because you were created in 1958. Car Mechanics was created in 1958. And then all I need is a couple of cars to illustrate that 70-year lineage from between 1958 and what will be 2028 when we mark 70 years. So then I thought, we'll get a Mark 1 Mini. So I know it's not quite 1958, but you get a 1959, 1960 Mark 1 Mini, and then get a modern BMW Mini to show that that's an illustration of 70 years of motoring right there. And we'll do it up at that garage. It's going to be something I want to try and do in the next 12 months. So plenty of time to plan it. But yes, that's that. What about you, Joe? What are you up to?
Much like Jeff, doing things with small cars. Obviously, I'm tinkering on my Fiat Seicento still. It's forever occupying me. This weekend, I'll be fitting some bucket seats. Because I've decided I'm going a little bit more aggressive with the interior of it. So I want something a bit lower and a bit more supportive. I've discovered that I have the weirdest shaped frame in the world, because I'm quite thin, but I've got very broad shoulders. Finding a set of seats that holds me in is quite hard to do. But I think I've cracked it. I've got a set of bucket seats I'm putting in with some red seat belts I've got and what have you. So yeah, that's going to be cool. And I'm sure my girlfriend will thank me endlessly the next time we have to make a long trip.
Very are you putting good. Harness belts in, Joe?
Or no, staying with seatbelts. I'm not doing harnesses.
Harness belts are really fun until you try and use them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's me. Bucket seat, and if the weather it holds, back out on the bike again.
I'm hoping to get out in the Audi TT this weekend. I sawned it for a couple of months just because I knew it wasn't going to be used for a period over the Easter because we were going away and lots of car shows and things. So I sawned it for a couple of months, put it back on the road at the start of this month, and then thought, well, actually, I should also take it in for a service because it was MOT'd in November, but it hadn't been serviced since the beginning of last year. You'll remember when we did the road trip a couple of years ago in it, the tailpipe was already a bit rusty then. When I got it out of its parking space, it also had a strange trajectory out from the back bumper. It was pointing slightly upwards. And it's at that point that I just sort of just put my foot on the rear silencer and I could basically pivot the whole rear segment like that, where it's kind of rotten through a kind of a join between the back box and the center section. So I then eked it to the garage where it was going to get its service, hoping that the whole thing didn't just fall off on the road. And sure enough, they confirmed that I'm going to get the middle section and the back box replaced, but it's probably the original system, so I'm not overly surprised. So hopefully I'm going to get out in the Audi because I've not been out in it for ages and ages, and I really want to. So hopefully I can get to enjoy the Audi for a first time in several months. So that'd be good. But anyway, our wants of the week, chaps. What are we gonna pick from our classifieds this week? So, Jeff,
my want of the week is slightly obscure. We were writing about the Renault Espace last week, and got me sort of delving into the history of Matra, and so I landed upon the Matra Rancho, of course, which is all but extinct. Let's say I've eventually found one in Italy. You're about to ruin my joke. Leave it alone. Look at that.
There we go.
Do you know what you've just done? You've completely ruined my joke.
What was your
I'm
joke?
I'm so sorry. Carry on.
You've completely ruined my joke. I found a Matra Rancho in Italy and it's 15,500 euros. So quite a lot of money. But then with a little bit more searching, I found one in Lyme Regis, of all places.
Wow.
And the problem was it's quite small. So now Phil has ruined my joke, but here it is.
Mine's slightly bigger than yours, but
But is yours boxed?
I do have the box for it, actually. It's not on the shelf. It's on the shelf unboxed.
Yours hasn't got funky rainbow stripes on it, has it?
What we have here is a large percentage of the total Matra Rancho population.
Yeah, but this one's not rusty either. It's quite good, really.
Oh, it's not authentic.
They're fabulous. I would have one as well. That'd be brilliant. Absolutely. Yeah,
but well done for completely destroying my punchline before
I'm so sorry.
Got anywhere near it.
I'm so sorry. I gave too many people. Those that are listening would have still been surprised.
So those of you listening, sorry.
This is we obviously meticulously pre-planned these podcasts, as you can see.
Exactly. But there we go. Joe, go on then. What's your want of the week?
So I've occupied this slot many a time with Porsches, usually 911s. This week it is a Porsche, but not a 911, because Jeff in particular will be able to relate to purveying a Facebook marketplace. It's a dangerous place to go if you're into old cars, because more often than not, it will just work out that you're into looking at old cars and throw up random old cars for you. This week, it threw up this. I'm going to show it to the camera. It was a Porsche 944. And
nice.
It, for me, was the perfect spec. It's Guards Red. It's got the Fuchs wheels on it. It's manual. It looks stunning. It's a 944 is a gorgeous looking thing anyway. I think this is absolutely lovely. And this one's 11 grand, which is not nothing. But in the world of 944s these days, that's not a huge amount. And I still feel like I've got unfinished business with 944s because I really, really like them. And sadly, that one we had a few years back was, I don't think it was a representative example, shall we say. I don't think you can make your conclusions on 944s based on that one.
No.
But I think they're absolutely gorgeous and I think they're only going to get more expensive from here. So yeah, if my 911 dream doesn't work out, I may have to go and buy a 944 because I think they're super cool. And that one's lovely.
I'd still have a 944 Cabriolet, actually. I'd love a drop-top 944. I think they're really quite pretty.
I know
you lose.
Personally, it's all about that big glass, that enormous glass tailgate.
I know. That clamshell kind of tailgate thing.
Yeah.
Looks really cool, doesn't it?
I do have to give a quick shout out to the channel All The Gear, who did a video camping in the back of a 924, thus demonstrating the space you don't get with that. But that's another story.
Wow. That's
it's 944 for me this week.
Very good. Well, you know what? I've been looking at so many cars this last few days. I've probably got a backlog, so I'm going to save some for next week that I can talk about. But You were talking about capable SUVs. I've been looking at Land Rover Freelanders.
Okay. Right.
They're 30 years old next year. 1997 they came out.
Wow.
So they're quite old now.
That is a proper feel old yet kind of thing, isn't it?
Jeez. Yes. And it goes into that category. There was a little bit of a purple patch for that sort of Rover era car, because you sort of think the MGF, Rover Metro, R8, Land Rover Freelander. There was this sort of stable of cars that almost were born out of creativity rather than loads of budget. They were just so resourceful. But actually, the outcome was quite good. And I know people get a bit scared about a K-Series 1 and head gaskety stuff, but I just think they're really good. And I started looking at, I'd really want a V6 one, truth be told.
Quite a rare beast now, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I couldn't find one, but I did find it. There was a nice 2.6 TD4 in silver, and that one's only 1,800 quid.
Yeah, they're good value.
And actually, I think still very fixable. Do you know what I mean? Like, if everything on there is just quite household items, so servicing them probably is pretty easy.
I'm surprised you haven't already got a Freelander. Bearing in mind, you like a Land Rover. You're a family man. You live where you live in sort of slightly rural Oxfordshire. I'm surprised you haven't already had one, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it's always been on a want list, actually. So I just curiously, again, saw one drive past the other day, and I thought, oh, I should look up and see if the prices have moved. And safe to say, they haven't. They're getting rarer, but they're
super cheap.
I think
it'll be like early discoveries. One day we'll all wake up and there'll be 10 grand. And we'll go, when the hell did that happen?
I suspect so, yeah. But a slightly sort of practical, rugged choice. But yeah, get one now before the 30th anniversary kicks in and we all realise they're quite rare and very capable and probably a very good example of Land Rover's history. But that probably concludes our weekly roundup of all things classic cars. Gents, thanks very much for your time. Viewers and listeners at home, thank you very much for your time and attention. Drop us a comment, a rating, a like, a follow, a subscribe, and all those things you're meant to do to help spread the word. We want more people to engage in our mindless drivel about old cars and many other things. Do get involved. But in the meantime, thanks very much for listening or watching wherever you are, and we'll catch you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Thank you.